physically and emotionally exhausted, Magellan climbed partway to the crow's nest to see the prospect for himself. His men, many of them about to succumb to scurvy, starvation, and dehydration, their tongues swollen, breath foul, and eyes glassy, raised their shaggy heads to glimpse their salvation. As the islands grew more distinct in the morning light, the lookout shouted again, "Tierra!" and gestured to the south, where cliffs rose from the sea. Overjoyed, Magellan awarded the fortunate lookout a bonus of 100 ducats. The first landmass Navarro had spotted was likely mountainous Rota. The other island, the one where the armada would eventually land, is now called Guam, an unincorporated territory of the United States. About 30 miles long, covering 209 square miles, Guam is the largest of an archipelago of volcanic islands known as the Marianas, which lie about 3,000 miles west of the Hawaiian Islands. For Magellan, the landfall on Guam came as a mixed blessing. Although the island provided shelter from the misery he and his men had endured during their 98-day Pacific cruise, nothing about it suggested they were anywhere near their goal, the Spice Islands. Nevertheless, it was land. Since leaving the western mouth of the strait, Magellan had traveled more than 7,000 miles without interruption, the longest ocean voyage recorded until that time. On Wednesday, the 6th of March, Albo's log includes an account of their discovery. "On this day, we saw land and went to it, and there were two islands which were not very large." And he adds, ominously, "We saw many small sailboats approaching us, and they were going so fast they seemed to fly." Albo was getting his first good look at the highly maneuverable outrigger canoe known as a proa, and often called a flying proa because it was able to attain speeds of up to 20 knots and seemed to fly over the water's surface, exactly as Albo recorded. The proas approaching Magellan's fleet were manned by a Polynesian tribe now known as the Chamorros. 4 hours after sighting land, the Armada de Malacca, surrounded by a welcoming party of outrigger canoes, entered a deep turquoise lagoon of exceptionally warm, clear water. As they approached, the sailors could see beaches, rocky cliffs, and steep, thickly forested slopes. The verdant landscape contained a paradise of springs, streams, and waterfalls, everything a sailor who has been too long at sea could want. The possibility of deliverance put the entire crew on edge. Jubilation alternated with watchfulness. The moment of contact between two societies, until now wholly ignorant of one another's existence, had finally arrived. At first, the Chamorros, hundreds of them, in their small maneuverable canoes, encircled the fleet. Taller and stronger than the Europeans, they boarded the flagship and stole everything they could, rigging, crockery, weapons, and anything made of iron. As the crew, in their weakened condition, pleaded with Magellan to force them to leave. Eventually, one sailor summoned the strength to retaliate. Ginez de Mafra recalled, "The bosun of the flagship slapped one of those Indians for a small reason, and the Indian slapped him back. Insulted, the bosun stabbed him in the back with a machete that he carried on his waist. At that, the Chamorros, a mob of barbarians," de Mafra now called them, "hurled themselves overboard. Once they were aboard their shoddy boats, they began fighting with their sticks, for they had nothing else." In the middle of the fracas, a second wave of Chamorros skimmed across the azure water in their proas, and to the Europeans' astonishment, distributed food to the starving sailors. Once they had fed the Europeans, the Chamorros took up their sticks and began fighting again, this time more viciously. De Mafra described how the Captain General narrowly averted disaster. Magellan, seeing that the number of people was increasing, ordered those in the ship to stop throwing arrows. With this, the Indians stopped, the fighting subsided, and they resumed selling food as before, the kind of food in those islands being coconuts and fish aplenty, which were purchased in exchange for some glass beads brought from Castile. Magellan's show of restraint turned out to be just the right gesture. If only matters had ended on this harmonious note. unaccustomed to European concepts of trade and property, the Chamorros, while happy to feed the sailors, failed to comprehend that some things aboard ship were simply off-limits. Pigafetta wrote, "Whilst we were striking and lowering the sails to go ashore, they stole away with the small boat called the skiff, which was made fast to the poop of the captain's ship." The next day, Magellan, much irritated, according to Pigafetta, retaliated. He was not about to let thieves make off with his personal vessel. He ordered 40 men into the two remaining longboats. Rowing mightily, the crews pushed past the reef's spume and reached the shore, the first landing by Europeans on an inhabited Pacific island. Then they went on a rampage, Pigafetta wrote. The captain general, in wrath, went ashore with 40 armed men, who burned some 40 or 50 houses, together with many boats, and killed 7 men. During the rampage, the stunned Chamorros offered no resistance, and the Europeans held their fire, but their crossbows were brutally effective. Pigafetta said, "When we wounded many of this kind of people with our arrows, which entered inside their bodies, they looked at the arrow, and then drew it forth with much astonishment, and immediately afterward they died, which moved us to great compassion." Amid the carnage, Magellan, said Pigafetta, recovered the small boat, and we departed immediately, pursuing the same course. Once again, the fleet plunged blindly into the expanses of the Western Pacific, with no clear idea how to reach the Spice Islands. Magellan set a westward course, journeying deeper into the unexplored reaches of the Pacific. The revitalized fleet enjoyed another marvelous week of sailing downwind, making 7 or 8 knots, top speed. On March 16th, a lookout spied the mountains of a large island rising from the sea in pale majesty. The fleet had reached the eastern edge of the Philippine archipelago, over 3,000 islands, most of which cover less than a square mile. Magellan sensed he was getting close to the Spice Islands, but he did not realize how close. Accounts of Philippine history begin abruptly in 1521 with Magellan's arrival, but centuries before, these islands were well known to Chinese and Arab traders, who, with their superior sailing technology, profitably trafficked among them and developed sophisticated trading networks with the native societies. Archaeological evidence suggests that trade between mainland Asia and the Philippines had become highly evolved as early as 1000 AD. By the time Magellan arrived, Filipinos who dwelled near oceans and inland waterways had long been literate. The sprawling Philippine archipelago did not exist on European maps, and neither Magellan nor his pilots knew what to make of their discovery. Magellan led his ships closer to the island of Samar, but within a mile or two of the shore, he found only unforgiving cliffs rising from the water and nothing resembling a safe harbor. Magellan's next landfall proved more satisfying than Samar. Homanhan Island did have a safe harbor, and Magellan, with tremendous relief, finally gave the order to drop anchor. He led his men ashore to an oasis of dense rainforest, palm trees, and abundant water, where they erected 2 sheltering tents. At last they were free of the stench of the ship's holds. Instead, their nostrils twitched with the mingled fragrances of palm trees, wet sand, and decaying vegetation. They slaughtered a sow they had brought from Guam and prepared a great feast for themselves. For a time, their bellies were full and the long-suffering sailors content. On Monday, March 18th, they saw a boat bearing 9 men approach from the direction of Suluan. Calculating the risks and rewards inherent in their second encounter with the peoples of the Pacific, Magellan made certain that arms were at the ready. At the same time, he assembled a different sort of arsenal, shiny trinkets, in case the encounter turned out to be peaceful. This time, Magellan handled the situation confidently. Pigafetta wrote, "The captain general ordered that no one should move or say anything without his leave. When those people had come to us in that island, forthwith the most ornately dressed of them went toward the captain general, showing that he was very happy at our coming, and 5 of the most ornately dressed remained with us, while the others who stayed at the boat went to fetch some of us who were fishing, and then they all went together." Pigafetta continued, Then the captain, seeing that these people were reasonable, ordered that they be given food and drink, and he presented them with red caps, mirrors, combs, bells, and other things. And when those people saw the captain's fair dealing, they gave him fish and a jar of palm wine, which they call in their language vraka, figs more than a foot long, that is, bananas, and other smaller ones of better flavor, and two coconuts. And they made us signs with their hands that in 4 days they would bring rice, coconuts, and sundry other food. Perhaps they had found paradise after all, or at least a respite from an expedition well into its second year. Each day Magellan fed coconut milk supplied by the generous Filipinos to the sailors still suffering from scurvy. Their idyll lasted a week, each day bringing with it new discoveries and a growing intimacy with their genial Filipino hosts. Pigafetta commented, "These people entered into very great familiarity and friendship with us, and made us understand several things in their language, and the name of some islands which we saw before us." But Magellan nearly destroyed the idyll when he invited the Filipinos aboard Trinidad. He did his guests a signal honor, or so he thought, by ordering his gunners to discharge their artillery, the awkward arquebuses. The roar shattered the silence and reverberated against the distant hills of Hamanham, terrifying the Filipinos, afraid for their lives, who, said Pigafetta, tried to leap from the ship into the sea. This might have been a gaffe, an excess of enthusiasm, or was Magellan trying to impress these defenseless islanders, and himself, with the power of his weapons? Magellan quickly reassured the frightened Filipinos and coaxed them into remaining on board. At the same time, he could not fail to notice that his weapons conferred absolute power over the islanders, should he ever feel the need to exert it.